Hello and welcome to the ICAEW Insights podcast. I'm Ian Wright, Managing Director of Reputation and Influence at the ICAEW, and I'm your host for today. And today we'll be discussing the 2023 spring budget that the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt presented to Parliament earlier this week, a budget he termed as a budget for growth. Now, many of its measures were trailed beforehand, with perhaps a single big exception. Now, to break down and make sense of the Chancellor's announcements and their potential impact on British business and the UK economy, I'm once again joined by Francis Hack, Chief Economist at Santander UK, and David Williamson, Political Editor at the Sunday Express. Francis and David, thanks for returning to the podcast. It's great to have you back.
Oh, hello.
Thank you.
Francis, can I start with you? From an economic and fiscal perspective, what did the Chancellor have to do with this budget?
Well, I would say he had to just keep calm and carry on. And I think that's probably where we ended up with the budget. It was interesting. We were all interested to know what the OBR would be saying about growth. And actually, their near-term growth forecasts are much more positive than I think we were expecting. They have downgraded it over the longer term. So from a sort of fiscal perspective, the headroom remains sort of the same. But I think for Jeremy Hunt, that was actually a real positive.
David, every budget's political because of the priorities, the choices and the decisions that chancellors have to make. So what did the Chancellor have to do with the politics around this budget?
He had to walk into the House of Commons and not fall over, essentially, which these days, the pyrotechnics of chaos that we've seen over the last 12 months, he did that with aplomb. He came in to appear competent and calm. He seemed very calm. So some people might say almost too calm. But he delivered a budget which, as Francis was saying, got the approval of the OBR. And what's really interesting is that, you know, it used to be that budgets were the one day in the year when all the limelight was on the Chancellor. And Chancellors are generally the most ambitious people in the room. And they would love it. But now everyone sits there waiting for the OBR. It's almost as much as waiting to hear what the Chancellor is going to say, because this is the moment where this sort of ex-cathedra voice comes out and tells you the state of the true economy and basically gives a verdict on whether the Chancellor is guilty of sophistry or not. But I think he'll be pretty happy with this. And the general feeling amongst MPs was, yeah, this is something which we can take to the doorstep.
Francis, I'm going to hand back to you. And David started talking about the OBR. And like him, I was going, oh, come on, Jeremy, just get on with it so I can read the OBR stuff. And the OBR was really interesting in terms of, as David mentioned, a brightening situation and scenario, an avoidance of recession. But the OBR is quite clear that structural weaknesses remain that have been exacerbated by recent shocks. And the OBR mentions three really important things that are going to impact upon our sustainable rate of growth, rising living standards, business investment, labour market participation and productivity. And the budget tried to address all of those. So maybe we could take them one by one. Business investment. Did the Chancellor do enough?
Well, I think he made a pretty good start on that one. The impression I got was it was slightly better than people were expecting. In terms of what the OBR thought, they reckoned it would increase business investment by about 3%, which is a good start given that we have always been very poor at business investment in the UK. So, I mean, hopefully that's a positive, but I would say it's a positive and something to build on. The interesting point was it was obviously time limited. And what a lot of people have been saying is we need more certainty. Therefore, it needs to be for a longer period of time. So, but of course, you know, we will be revisiting this again at some point, I suspect. So it'll be interesting to see what happens from that perspective. But generally, I would say definitely a positive.
You say it's a positive, Francis. Do you think it has real impact upon growth? Because it looks from both the Red Book and the OBR's figures that it brings forward business investment. So it's higher than it would be in the first 2 years of the period. But then falls away in the next 3 years up to 2027, 2028. Does it have a real impact upon growth?
Well, I think it will in the near term. And it's all around confidence as well, business investment. If businesses feel that we're in the right environment, we're moving towards a growth environment, then they might want to invest more. So sort of bringing it forward now when business investment is very low, where there's a lot of uncertainty, is a positive. But what we would want to see is obviously in the future that that business investment continues. And also, I mean, the one thing I would point out, this is not technically business investment, but government capital spending, there was very little said on that, and that is still very low given where we are. You kind of need these things to work together. You know, business investment isn't just one thing. You sometimes need the capital spending from government in order for it to work together. So, you know, there are definitely still things that can be done.
David, I'm going to ask about the politics of this. Would Tory MPs have preferred a decision not to go ahead with that big rise in corporation tax?
Oh, there are many, many MPs for whom this is something which makes them churn inside, thinking, you know, we are the party of low taxes, supposedly, and what's going on. However, I think they are still so traumatised by the events of the autumn that there hasn't been anything like the clamour that you would expect. And I think also that Jeremy Hunt, he seemed to have a very good reception, apparently, when he was selling this to MPs yesterday evening. And then I think his argument that being able to write off so much investment in your own company and that will mean that it's only a minuscule proportion of companies that are actually paying the full rate. That seems to have settled the waters. But the fact is that everyone's eyes are not on the next few weeks or even the next few months, but on next year's general election. And they realise that before that happens, we've got an autumn statement and we've got another budget. And to be able to do anything exciting when things are so constrained at the minute means having absolute stability and no shocks or trauma or chaos at this point in that saga. So I think everyone has very much fastened their seatbelts and is going, okay, we've got through this stage, but there's going to be a lot of excitement ahead. And it's really just an absolute existential challenge for whether they remain in power or not.
He mentioned there was a particularly interesting part of the speech where he talked about the investment zones. And he made reference to Michael Heseltine in Liverpool and Canary Wharf. And he said he announced 12 new Canary Wharfs around the country. Does that excite the Tory backbenchers in terms of their prospects for re-election?
I think it does. It does, because Hesse casts a fascinating shadow. And he's one of those people who just has, throughout all of the decades, even now, hasn't faded away. And whenever Conservatives are trying to point to something verifiably great that they achieved, it does help that they can point at Canary Wharf and say, look, you know, this is an icon of regeneration. And although in Liverpool they've never reaped actual electoral rewards there, they point to Heseltine's involvement in the extraordinary transformation of the waterfront, the city. And, of course, New Labour took a lot of that energy as well. And I suppose trying to rekindle that you know, both the Heseltine and the Blairite vision of urban renaissances, that's something which I think if they can get that and sense of anticipation that something's happening back into the national conversation at a moment whenever so many communities have seen their high streets, which had been booming, but whenever great, you know, flagship department stores are closing all across the country, that type of thing, that's what leads to the line that, you know, there's nothing in my high street except the odd coffee shop and a vaping store. And Red Wall MPs particularly say that the diminishment of high streets, which used to be places of gathering and places of really civic identity, that sense of decline there was one of the most powerful motivating things in 2019. So if ahead of 2024, they can get some sort of anticipation that, OK, there was a global pandemic, there was a war in Ukraine, but the type of prosperity that we've seen in London, we may be getting some of that magic, that would be very powerful. But it's an immense challenge to actually communicate that across.
Francis, I'm really interested in what David was saying there, and he mentioned Michael Heseltine, you know, arguably one of the key architects of industrial policy in Britain over the last 40 years or so. Reading the Red Book and then thinking about what the Chancellor had said, Do you think that we've got an industrial strategy in all but name? He talked about quantum technology. He talked about energy security with things like carbon capture, usage and storage, the setting up of Great British Nuclear. He mentioned the creative industries and advanced manufacturing.
You certainly got the impression that they wanted to focus on particular areas. I mean, life sciences as well, and obviously medicine, and definitely tech and entertainment very much came through. And entertainment, not just as in helping from the perspective of, you know, people coming to visit the UK. So I found that quite interesting. There was definitely a lot of very specific references to certain industries, if you like. And so, yes, it kind of gave that flavour of an industrial sort of strategy policy. But I mean, it's no way gone far enough, really, in terms of what that might look like. And that's partly, I suspect, because of this issue around capital spending by the government, that they're slightly hamstrung by that. But it was quite positive to hear them saying, you know, this is where we want to focus, because I think that has been missing of late. I think everyone knows that life sciences and digital and tech are areas that we've been wanting to focus on, but it was good for them to actually properly mention it in the budget.
The second part of what the OBR was talking about in terms of structural weaknesses was labour market participation. And there'd been a lot of talk about this in the run-up to the budget. Indeed, you know, a lot of measures that have been announced. The big surprise was the abolition of the lifetime allowance for pensions, when we were expecting some sort of move from about £1 million to 1.8. But now it's just absolutely abolished. Frances, will that actually help people get back into the workforce?
I was slightly surprised by that one. I could understand, obviously, increasing it, and I could understand increasing the yearly allowance. That would make sense to me. I was slightly surprised by the way he abolished it, partly because, and obviously, a lot of the headlines today have been around that helping the sort of 1% of the richest people. Well, that may be in the case of people who have retired, but of course, there's a lot of people currently who would fall into that 1% bracket that actually are bound by the tapering of pensions. So, and nothing was mentioned on that, and I couldn't find any reference to that in the Red Book, but maybe I need to look at it in more depth. So from that perspective, I was slightly surprised. But I mean, in terms of getting them back to work, it certainly might get some of the doctors, which you got the impression that's who it was aimed for, back into work. I mean, in terms of the childcare, which you sort of mentioned at the beginning, obviously that doesn't come in for another year. But I mean, hopefully that will help to bring potentially new mothers and fathers back into the workplace.
Do you think, in terms of the measures that have been put in place, that the childcare announcement, and I'll speak to David about the politics of pensions in a minute, that is the big factor that will really help?
I think it certainly will help. Of course, the devil's in the detail. So how much then nurseries and childcare providers then get in order to be able to offer this, that's the really key question.
David, you mentioned earlier that, you know, Tory MPs were fairly buoyant. You know, people were happy. Jeremy Hunt had gone to speak to them and there was a bit of optimism. Is this the area, though, in terms of the politics, where over the next 24, 48, 72 hours, as we go into the Sunday papers, this is the area that the budget will unravel? Because is this the equivalent, David, of Liz Truss's and Kwasi Kwarteng's, the abolition or allowance of a banker's bonus? You know, it's just helping the rich in a cost of living crisis that's causing enormous difficulties. And there was no talk of a pay rise for public sector workers.
That is certainly where Labour are already going. And that is the focus of the attack, that this is making life fantastic for people who already have pretty fantastic lives by the standards of most people. And they can also then claim that actually by freezing the income tax thresholds, you know, basic rate taxpayers, I mean, there's various figures being thrown around, but, you know, some suggesting that around an extra £650. And the IFS is certainly, and the Resolution Foundation, they have their big reports out as well, which go through it. And that, there's a lot of stuff in there which will make quite tough reading for people who, again, are championing a low tax economy. But essentially, the government had a choice. And it was, do they choose to spend £6 billion or so on freezing fuel duty and keeping the 5p cut? Or do they plough that into public sector pay boosts? and they chose to go for the motorists. That's certainly how it seems. But the interesting thing is that the snap poll that came out from Savanta afterwards is something which I think Jeremy Hunt would be quite delighted by, with 49% supporting the budget and only 20% opposing it. And when it came to things like continuing the help to keep energy bills down, 79% like it, 71% liking the 5p fuel duty cuts. You know, those types of things, those stats will just be music in the Treasury. It'll show, right, you know, we have a nation where people are feeling that their wallets are suddenly so much lighter than they were a year ago, and they are saying, we like this. So it's very dangerous for any politician to bank on the gratitude of voters. But I think at the moment, and certainly Labour, as you say, are going to be absolutely hammering home the threats to lower income earners who are still sitting in the tax thresholds. But I think Jeremy Hunt is going to be quite relaxed this weekend in comparison to how previous chancellors have experienced the aftermath of their budgets in recent times.
Francis, it's always dangerous to talk about things that weren't in the budget because it could be an absolute endless list. But given the talk about, say, supply-side reform and those structural weaknesses I referred to earlier, about things like labour market participation and productivity, I was surprised there was no real reference to skills. Were you? And was that a missed opportunity?
Yes, there certainly wasn't any real reference in his speech. I did notice that they are putting some money into skill boot camps and getting the over 50s sort of back into work in terms of reskilling. So there was some money going into that, but it wasn't a headline. I mean, it wouldn't be at 63 million. So in some ways, yes, a bit of a missed opportunity, I think, because skills is the one area where we do have an issue, and with labour supply so tight, we really need to be focusing on that as well as getting people back into work. But getting people back into work just simply isn't enough, and it's not going to be. We need to be able to reskill the workforce too. So it was a bit of a shame, I think, that there wasn't a bit more focus on that as well.
Should there have been more of a focus on, say, reform of the apprenticeship levy so businesses can really take it up? And there's a lot of administrative hassle when it comes to that.
Yes, I mean, there was trailed that there might be some change to that. So I was slightly surprised not to read about it. As I say, I do think they really need to think about how they're going to push that agenda forward. Now, you know, reskilling the workforce is not just for government. It's obviously for businesses. It's for individuals. It's a responsibility for all of us. But you do at least need the government to come up with some policies that will help, some initiatives that will help businesses to be able to do that.
I'm going to stay with you, Francis, on that third structural weakness, which I suppose is very much linked into business investment and labour market participation, that of productivity. Now, all developed economies have struggled since the global financial crash some 15 years ago. We're particularly in the UK afflicted with low stagnating levels of productivity. Will this budget, one single budget, help move the dial on this?
I think it will take a long time to move the dial on this. There's an awful lot that needs to be done to increase productivity in the UK. I mean, this is a start, and it will be interesting to see how this moves forward in, you know, the next budget, whether they'll be able to do a bit more in that. But it's a start, but it's not going to be enough to really push the dial at the moment on productivity, or at least in the next year.
And David, productivity is one of the biggest economic challenges facing us. You know, living standards, means to combat the cost of living, can't really be dealt with unless we start dealing with productivity. Is Westminster geared up to addressing productivity? You know, it's not on the lips of every sort of marginal floating voter up and down the constituencies, is it? Should it be?
No, and it's something that's quite hard to sell, because I think during Gordon Brown's premiership, I think he understood that productivity was the big challenge. But how you actually sell that on the doorstep? Are you essentially saying that you want people to work harder when they're already feeling that they're working every single hour of every day? And Tony Blair certainly felt that there was a bit of a challenge in trying to encourage what he talked about, lifelong learning, of how everyone gains new skills as they go along. And that's a positive message, but it also came coupled with a bit of uncertainty because you're saying, gosh, you know, I'm aware that, job insecurity is so much higher than it was in our parents' generation. And the concept of a job for life is falling away. So whenever he was talking about the need to relearn, that made people feel, the weekly challenge of just, feeding the kids and getting their increasing shoe sizes catered for, that type of thing. So it's a tough one for politicians. And there's also, interestingly, in some conservative circles, a little bit of concern that's already been voiced about, for example, with the childcare, where they're saying, are we saying that the highest social contribution that individuals can make is being in a private sector workplace, essentially, or in the public sector as well, but sort of part of the grand profit-making machine of the country? Do we need to be actually finding a way for a better life? And in some conservative circles, you increasingly hear actually what would have once been called left-of-centre language, talking about the need to actually tax giant multinational companies that have such an impact on our everyday lives, but don't really come under the democratic control of even a single country anymore. And so that's really fascinating, that conversation, which would have once been seen as quite left-wing concerns, is creeping onto the right. And I think we're going to see a bit of an argument around the next manifesto about how to bring together that hunger for a lifestyle in Britain where people are able to do satisfying employment that isn't fraught with anxiety, and also see living standards rise, but also genuinely feel that that their work is leading to a life that they enjoy. And back in 2010, we saw an inkling of that type of thing with David Cameron's Big Society. And it was the idea that you could be empowered not just to thrive in the workplace, but also to bring that entrepreneurial energy into delivering things that would enrich your community. Now, of course, the problem was that there wasn't actually a big check to fund those dreams. And there certainly isn't going to be any big checks for that type of thing any time in the future. But it's where both Labour and the Conservatives have a real challenge to sort of say that success for a country goes beyond simply the GDP.
You were talking at the start about people feeling quite optimistic about this, that the Chancellor has done what he needed to do in respect of settle the ship after the chaos of September and October, and things are looking up. We've got a brighter outlook. But actually, things still remain incredibly challenging. The OBR has said that real living standards are going to be 0.4% lower than pre-pandemic levels in 2027-2028. We'll have essentially had a decade of no or declining living standards. And that's on top of the previous decade where productivity and living standards have been low as well. So things are still quite bleak, aren't they?
Well, the OBR's probably most terrifying prediction was about the slump in house prices, because that suddenly actually does translate where you have a nation of homeowners and aspirant homeowners, and you have these things which, a huge segment of the country would love to own a home but can't get on the housing ladder, or in a very small home and wondering, are they ever going to be able to have a house with a garden, and the kids are getting bigger, that type of thing. And the other people are mortgaged to the hilt, paying far more than they imagined they would ever be paying. And then seeing the value of the greatest asset in their lives, something that is that is where there is actually real cause for political concern, and also the fact is that the greatest asset could come out of the economy is if Jeremy Hunt can point, along with Rishi Sunak, to a huge crash in inflation by the end of the year, and the 2.9% figure. That even if that happens just by sitting still, that will look like a great achievement, because we have an entire generation that hasn't seen the type of inflation that's just roared through the country so recently. So if that happens, Rishi can point to one of his five pledges and say, look what's happened, we've more than halved inflation. So that will be the great torch that he can flourish. But if people are still feeling that their houses and their mortgages are a source of pain rather than pride, that's going to be very, very difficult for him to cope with. And the other great uncertainty is that a huge amount of the positivity in the economy comes from this assumption that fuel costs and energy costs are actually going to decline, that we're through the worst of the crisis that was sparked by Ukraine. There's a lot, we everybody desperately hopes that that's the case, but we are living in a time of extraordinary geopolitical instability. And who would actually bet a fiver that we're not going to see huge shocks? And during the actual Chancellor's statement, of course, there were actually headlines about instability in the banking sector. And there was almost a sense of, oh, is the real story happening out there? But having said all that, as you mentioned, the Chancellor does have a knack at portraying optimism. And certainly Rishi, I think he sees that the run-up to the next election is a bit of a triple jump, because we've seen things like the Windsor Agreement on the Northern Ireland Protocol, where there was no point trying to negotiate with the EU. Yeah, he's very happy to take the credit for what looks like a breakthrough that goes beyond what a lot of people didn't say. It's by no means in the bag. The DUP have the propensity to cause a lot of chaos, but that was seen as a win. And indeed, for an issue that does mean a lot to a lot of Tory MPs and a lot of Conservative voters, illegal immigration, he's been prepared to risk far greater controversy than people might have imagined. So this budget was part of that triple jump of sort of steadying the ship, but also sending the message that there are key wedge issues, which mean that the next election is, in Conservative eyes, by no means a foregone loss. And the mountain that Labour has to climb just to get to hung Parliament territory, any sophologist would just look at that and say, that's the K2, that's an Everest-style thing. So it really, the test is to whether Sir Keir Starmer has the Edmund Hillary in him to get up that summit in a very short amount of time.
Francis, David mentioned about geopolitical shocks, instability, and he talked about the banking sector. And of course, while the budget was taking place, we've had Silicon Valley Bank, we've had concerns about Credit Suisse. Are we looking at a 2008 global financial crash? Is this going to be 2023's crisis?
Well, I have to say, whilst I was listening to the budget, I did get an email about Credit Suisse, and I sent that to my team going, oh no, please, not another crisis. I don't think I can cope with yet another one. But the SVB and the Credit Suisse, they're quite different in the issues that they had. Credit Suisse has been known about, so it won't have come as such a surprise to the market, whereas I think SVB was definitely a shock in that respect. And it's difficult because I would say from a UK perspective, the banking sector is, it's well capitalised, we're very well regulated, and so a lot of the issues shouldn't be there, but there's always that contagion effect that comes through, confidence and all the rest of it. Confidence is so key in the world of economics. So I don't think there should be a problem. Markets, certainly when I came in, were steadying from a financial perspective, so hopefully the outlook is not for another crisis. But, it really matters what people think. And sometimes even, when regulators go out and say we're going to do this, that and the other, it's just not enough. So, time will tell. But hopefully the UK should be OK.
I'm going to push you on this, Francis. You mentioned that in the UK, the banking system is very well regulated. Before Christmas, and I think we talked about this at the last podcast, actually, the Chancellor was announcing his Edinburgh reforms as a way of making sure that the city and its regulatory environment remains competitive. And that means maybe some loosening of regulation and the regulatory activity. Will he take a step back as a result of what's going on in the banking sector at the moment, do you think?
Well, I think he might hang on a little longer before announcing anything. Having said that, there are problems out there that do need to be resolved. You can see that from, a lot of organisations, this has certainly been in the press, moving from the London Stock Exchange to the New York Stock Exchange for various reasons. So I do think that reform may well be needed in order to address some of the problems. There's also an issue I know around pensions and the fact that they have to make lifestyle changes, which is causing an issue for them. So there is definitely, I think, a need to have a look at some of the regulation, but obviously they won't want to be doing it on the back of a crisis. So I think it will be just to wait and see how this pans out.
I'm reluctant to start closing the podcast on a downbeat note, given what the Chancellor was trying to do. But I can't help it. And again, reading the OBR, I mentioned to David, you know, living standards going down, but looking at some of the OBR's comments, you know, post-war high tax burden of 37.7% in 2027-28, the highest ratio of corporation tax receipts to GDP since the tax was introduced in 1965, the ratio of public spending to GDP will be at 43.4%, which is the highest sustained level since the 1970s. Is this what the economic environment is that we just find ourselves in now? High tax, high spend, high intervention. Everybody, as a result of what the short-term shocks like the pandemic, but long-term things such as the transition to net zero, particularly an aging population, this is what we have to do. We'll have to tax and spend more.
I think that this is a big issue, because unless you're going to completely change the NHS, and obviously you mentioned climate change, it's going to be very hard with an ageing population that we have, and labour supply being, you know, so tight. You're going to have to tax a fair bit more in order to be able to spend what people want you to spend. So it's really a question of what do the electorate want? You know, do they want to be taxed less, which therefore means you're going to be able to spend less? You can't have it both ways. And I think we actually did touch on this on the last podcast, that the numbers have got to stack up at some point. And we know we can't carry on, you know, just spending, because the financial markets won't allow that. So, you know, I think it is absolutely key for everyone to think about what is it that we want the state to provide. And if it is the level that we have at the moment, then unfortunately you have to accept the fact that you're going to be taxed higher as a result. So it very much will depend what the electorate actually want.
I'm going to try and show you things up at the end. I'm going to ask you, at the start of the podcast, I was asking, you know, going into the budget, what were the economic, fiscal and political factors that the Chancellor had to deal with? Given what we've heard since he's announced his budget, out of 10, how do you think he's done in terms of what he had to do? How would you mark his homework, Frances?
I would say, actually, he's done a good job. He's done what he said he would do, which actually I think is very important. I'm not saying that there aren't significant supply side reforms that are still required, you know, around education and planning. But I mean, I think he did what he said he would do. So, I mean, out of 10, I'd maybe give him a 6, 7.
That's interesting. And David, what would you think?
The thing is, with budget, everyone's sort of haunted by the memories of the so-called omnishambles budget. We're recording, you know, less than 24 hours after he delivered that, so we don't know whether there's a hidden pasty tax lurking in there and a whole set of things. But I think the immediate thing, from a political perspective, I think he'd probably give himself an 8 or a 9 out of 10, and I think his colleagues would probably give him about a 7 out of 10, just in terms of creating a sense of wow, yeah, you know the ship of state is still sailing, and the public reaction has been generally supportive. Also, he managed, despite having such constrained finances, to be able to just press a few buttons that are going to be huge at the next election. You know, the pressing the childcare button, there'll be immense frustration amongst people who it doesn't come in on time. But there will be people who will benefit so hugely, because for so many of us, you know, childcare is the second mortgage, and you know, the time of eye-watering expense, that could go quite well. And also, the decision to scrap work capability assessments, if that works, that will be a great landmark. Now, he's left himself a lot of time to introduce that fully, but especially amongst the social justice wing of the Conservative Party, there has been such push for reform there. People such as the Centre for Social Justice, that type of wing, they can point to several big wins in this budget. So both the left and the right can cling on to hope that they are in government with a purpose, and actually, in the most turbulent and difficult times, changing Britain perhaps marginally, one step at a time for the better. So I think they'll be quite content. But everybody's eyes are set on 2024 at the moment.
Well, that was a grounds for optimism at the end. But I did notice, David, you were quite clever there. You said what the Chancellor would rate himself. You said what the Tory MPs would rate doing. You never offered an opinion yourself. You should be a politician rather than a political editor. That sounds like a perfect place to end things. Francis, David, thank you very much for joining us and sharing your thoughts on the 2023 spring budget.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can listen to the next In Focus podcast later this month when host Philippa Lamb will be exploring local authority audit and assurance with a panel including Dame Meg Hillier MP, Chair of the Public Accounts Committee. Don't miss that one. And in the meantime, if you found this useful, please let us know by rating, reviewing and sharing this episode and subscribing to ICAW Insights on your podcast app. Many thanks for listening.